Hi, welcome again to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I'm the co-chair of Hughes, Sutherland Reed's Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice Group. With me, as always, is my good friend Brent Carlson, the director at the Berkeley Research Group. Today is Thursday, August 21st, just after 4 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Brent, great to see you as always. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here as always.
Brent, what are we going to talk about on this episode?
Well, we got two main discussion topics. We're talking about a little bit of follow-on conversation from our last pod, deals, more deals, and protective backstops. Just a little bit more perspectives on that. We've got carrots and sticks coming through the export controls world, and we'll sort of unpack that a little bit. There's also just this week, just the other day, a new law signed by President Trump, Maintaining American Superiority by Improving Export Control Transparency Act. We're going to talk about that in terms of what that means, what it does and what it doesn't do, and unpack that a little bit. There's also in the news today some more discussion in the Dow Jones Risk Journal about the proposed 50% rule. There's big debates, big discussions in terms of where export controls are going. Despite the twists and turns that we have going on, the signals are clear. Carrots and sticks are coming in equal measure, and it's important to keep that in mind. To be able to get the carrots, one has to avoid the sticks as well.
Let's start by picking up where we left off at the last episode. Brent, what else do we want to cover regarding some of the deals that we talked about last week?
The news was the deal that President Trump worked out with NVIDIA, and which may be extended to other companies as well, where they would share 15% of their revenues from China-related sales of their H20 chip with the U.S. government. There's been a lot of debate on this. You'd see a lot of debate on both sides in terms of what this means for export controls. On one side, you've got some people saying, does this mean export controls are going away? Does this just mean we're sort of dropping them? On the other side, there's the national security element, which are really sort of up in arms on this and saying, whoa, this is actually a really big mistake from a national security perspective. Even though it may be an obsolete chip from a compute side, it is a very powerful chip in other applications, including inference. Let's talk about that 15% concept. It certainly is original thinking on the part of the president, but instead of relieving any sort of burden of export controls, it actually just places companies in an even more compromising position. No matter how that revenue sharing deal is going to get hashed out, the government could come back at any time with enforcement actions that would just simply add more money to government coffers, which could even be potentially greater than the 15% deals themselves.
Sometimes be careful what you wish for, right, Brent? While it may be useful to have the federal government with a financial incentive in promoting your sales, if something goes badly, if there's more, for example, social media clips of people laughing while they unpack prohibited equipment in China, well, now the president, now the White House, now the administration might be embarrassed by that. This goes back to what we were saying earlier, Brent, on the last episode about some of these statements by the administration about how essentially the types of things that we should be worried about are not the types of things that are easy to smuggle, and how that was being reported, at least if you read the headlines and the media reports conveying those statements, as the administration signaling that they weren't being supportive of export controls. It's a double-edged sword. The danger there is that if something does happen, well, they're not going to say it would have been easy for them to catch it. They're going to say it would have been easy for the exporter to catch it, and they're going to blame the exporter for having allowed that to happen. There's lots of debate, and has been for some time, about the ease or the difficulty of smuggling. It's an arithmetic game. Does it have to be one big shipment? Can it be a million other shipments? Nobody is more capable of throwing, you know, human compute at a problem than China is. The other angle of this is that they're not saying ship it without a license. You have to apply for licenses. In the license applications, you have to say, well, who are the end users going to be? Who's the ultimate consignee in the archaic terminology of global trade? If something bad happens, they're going to look back at the relevant license application. What if it's not the same ultimate consignee or end user that it ended up being? It doesn't mean that anyone knew where it would end up, but it does mean you're going to start getting questions about that. And they're going to work their way down the chain until they can find where it went.
Absolutely. I think there were situations where you had many companies out there taking a position where they weren't applying for licenses based upon technical parameters only. However, there's also end use and end user provisions and catch-all provisions that still may require a license, even if the item is EAR 99. So we're in a situation now where license applications are required. In terms of the company now applying for a license. You didn't apply for a license before. What sort of due diligence did you do on this customer that would identify and address any red flags of military end use or military intelligence end use, let alone WMD applications? Any sort of expedited export licensing program will certainly come with more requirements around transparency and enforcement hooks. And these are going to involve integrity in the due diligence process and in the representations made in those license applications. That's also going to be leveraging that full definition of knowledge under the EAR, which includes an awareness of a high probability to identify, address, and mitigate any red flags that we've talked about and wrote about a lot in our Fresh Look series and here in our Red Flags Rising podcasts.
And how's this going to come about, right? Let's just think in a real world, what's going to happen. I don't think anyone at any exporter would see, for example, Iran UAV program as the ship to entity and just ship it without going through at least a discussion about whether they need a license for that. So it's going to be things that aren't what they seem on paper, but then something's going to happen. There's going to be some battlefield recovery. There's going to be some ship that's stopped by U.S. Navy SEALs and searched. There's going to be something where the evidence that the diversion happened is going to be staring everyone in the face, or it's going to be name your investigative journalist from Reuters, Bloomberg, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. I'm leaving out probably a few that have all covered stories like this. They're going to ask a question to the U.S. government. How could you have allowed this to be shipped to these people? The U.S. government's going to look at the license and they're going to go to the company, to the exporter and say, okay, how did this get there? What did you miss? We've talked about this a lot, Brent. You know, what is the real objective? And it's maybe a bit cynical, but I think a bit realistic of any risk assessment exercise or any heightened due diligence procedure. It's to make and then importantly, be able to defend the choices that you make based on tremendously imperfect information, based on subjective judgments that you have to make in the absence of perfect information, right? You want to be able to say, if you're one of these exporters kicking back some revenue to the U.S. government, that, well, look, here is how we evaluated potential risk of an improper end user. Here's how we drew lines. Here's how maybe it's sampling, maybe it's triage, maybe it's a combination of both. We stopped all this other stuff here. And look, we even got requests or purchase orders from XYZ, but we blocked those because we thought, hey, you know what? They're in the same building. The name actually says Defense University in the Chinese or whatever it might be. Yeah, we missed this one, but here's as best we can tell why. But if it's sitting there in the press, if it's recovered on the battlefield or somewhere it's not supposed to be, the question is going to come back on you from the U.S. government.
Absolutely. There's just a whole lot more transparency coming in this whole export controls world than I think we've ever seen before in the past.
These deals might seem exciting in the first instance to the exporters involved who would have opportunities that they're not going to have otherwise. But there's a lot that's going to come along with this. And it's not just going to be business as usual as a private company. It's sort of a lowercase p partnership with the federal government, certainly in terms of reputation. Companies in these arrangements with the United States should expect an increased expectation for transparency and likely some questions coming back maybe more aggressively than they might otherwise have had.
There has been a loud cry and hue from the national security community on this deal. The perception was that the real competition for AI dominance between the United States and China really revolved around compute. Well, it's been shifting a little bit over the last several months, where it's not just compute, it's also inference as well. Because that H20 chip, while it may be obsolete or just plain crappy from a compute perspective, it is an excellent chip and far beyond what China can currently produce from an inference perspective. That is a part of this whole equation. Now, you know, it's sort of above our pay grade where that line is going to be drawn in terms of that technological threshold of what's going to be allowed to be sold to China or other countries that are not aligned with the United States. But there's also another element to this. No matter where that's going to get drawn, there is a certain element where added transparency into exactly where all this stuff is going does bring certain national security benefits of their own. It's a fluid situation. Innovation keeps moving forward, so those lines are going to keep moving. It's important for companies to put in those protective backstops in their compliance programs so that they are ready for when the situation could change. And the situation could change at any moment. And that protective backstop involves leveraging the high probability standard to be able to answer questions from BIS, the DOJ, Congress on where your products are going and for what purpose, which means what due diligence did you do? How did you do it? How did you identify and address those red flags as to end users and end use?
Brent, and why might Congress in particular be asking more questions? It's because of this new law that was signed into effect by the president just the other day, the Maintaining American Superiority by Improving Export Control Transparency Act. It's 1.5 pages, and it's really right. Just one key subparagraph. The report requires, at minimum, annual reports by BIS to Congress on end use checks, as well as license applications related to export, re-export, release, and in-country transfer of items controlled under the Export Control Reform Act of 2018, to which this is an amendment, for each license application or other request for authorization, who submitted it, a brief description of the item with the ECCN, if it has one, the reason for the control, if applicable, the name of the end user, so not ultimate consignee or intermediary, but the end user's location, in addition to the value of the item, the decision that BIS made with respect to the license application or authorization and the date the license application or authorization request was submitted. This is not a comprehensive reporting of all license applications to all places. It's limited to covered entities. If you go down to the next page, at least in the PDF version that we have, covered entities are defined to be entities in D5, let's say arms embargoed countries as a shorthand, but that includes China, for example, that is also an entity that is either on the BIS entity list or the military end use list. Brent, what's your take on this?
This is a great step forward, but there's a lot of pieces here that it doesn't address. It's not going to be a big fix-all. This is a big step forward to prevent us from being galactically stupid, so you don't have bad actors just walking through the front door or licenses being approved through the front door to these military end users or companies on the entity list. Or if they are, there will be scrutiny from Congress, and that's fine. However, things just don't go through the front door. The biggest issue is diversion and smuggling. This does not address that at all. Let's give an example. Export controls go on China, and then immediately the next quarter you see sales balloon through Singapore. Is Singapore a D5 country? No, it's not. This act is a big step forward to close the front door, but as the saying in Chinese goes, Zohoman, you go through the back door. That's what you do. We talked about this on an earlier pod where preventing diversion starts close to home. When you're thinking about General Prohibition 10 and the full definition of knowledge, you could have a front company in the United States. This would not catch it. You could be sending restricted technology all around the world that ends up being in the PRC through front companies. This won't catch it. I congratulate Congress for passing this. It closes the front door, but it doesn't address the back door at all. It doesn't really add any more burden on companies. It's more burden on the reporting from BIS.
Thinking about it that way, this seems like a belt and suspenders approach because it essentially requires reporting of what should already be something that is known and dealt with by BIS and by exporters. To me, the question is, well, whose problem is this going to be? We've seen many members of Congress be very vocal in hearings, in their correspondence with the Secretary of Commerce about trying to improve the enforcement of U.S. export controls. Let's say there's a smuggling ring, right? They aren't putting China as the end use location. They're putting something like Singapore or Malaysia on it. What would happen is that there'd again be some scandal that happens. Members of Congress ask questions and they demand from BIS, what did you think was happening? We look back at your annual report and we saw nothing about this particular export that we know happened because we see it. Some item is being used by someone who shouldn't be using it. And then BIS is going to go back to the application it received and think, well, what did we miss? And, you know, BIS is not going to miss something where it's General Trading Company in Jebel Ali or it's a Happy Trading Enterprise in a Skyrise in Hong Kong, right? They're going to ask questions of exporters of things like that. So it's going to be things that don't look obviously on their face from just their name like a front company. What's BIS going to do? It's going to go back to the exporter and say, you know, this is really not super awesome that we're getting embarrassed in front of Congress because this thing happened. What'd you guys miss? And maybe that's the discussion, right? Maybe it's what'd you guys miss? Let's have a discussion about it. Maybe it's a little more aggressive than that.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of potential for both BIS and Congress to get riled on this because there may be over expectation that this will address a lot of issues and gaps in export controls in terms of both compliance and enforcement. It only increases transparency over the front door. The real action, the real issues are happening through the back door.
There's one way BIS could avoid having to share the license application with Congress. There's an exception for BIS that if sharing the information would potentially jeopardize an ongoing investigation, they can hold it back. That might incentivize them to bring more investigations more quickly if they start to smell out smuggling issues or see things, even just in media reports or blog posts or social media, that gives them concern.
And we do know that administrative subpoenas have been on the rise. So there's a lot of information that BIS has been assembling that could turn into full-on investigations at any time. That is an issue that legal and compliance teams at companies should be thinking about strategically and how best to protect themselves. The other big elephant in the room, besides the D5 group countries, arms embargo countries, is what about companies that don't even apply for an export license? That could be a big issue where more transparency is expected by the administration, by Congress, by BIS. And I think there's going to be a lot more pressure on outreach visits to make sure that export licenses are being applied for when they should be. It's not just going to be those technological thresholds again. It's going to be what's the end use, what's the end user, what due diligence did you do? Did you take into account General Prohibition 10, which also refers to requiring taking into account the full definition of knowledge under the EAR? How did you identify and address any of those red flags? How did you come to that decision of not applying for a license? I think that is a potential to trip up a lot of companies.
Well, if you think about what is likely to cause an issue that BIS and the exporters will want to try to avoid, it's not someone getting an item classification wrong once, right? The item classification is relatively objective. What can this thing do technologically? What are its capabilities? What people will get tripped up on is, oh gosh, did we have knowledge that this was going to a prohibited end use or end user? We saw in the recent $140 million enforcement action how tricky that could be, to be honest, because knowledge is not just what the trade compliance team is told. It's not just what's on the license application. It's not what's just in the purchase order or the commercial invoice. It's what does your company know, aggregating the collective knowledge of all of the employees involved. So that includes your sales team. That includes your logistics team. That includes your customer service team. That includes your warranty team, if that's different. So all of those things are likely to be an area where BIS might be a little more aggressive in its outreach visits, frankly, just from an educational perspective. These things can be managed, but only if you jump ahead of the game, lean into the curve, and start thinking proactively now about where do you think your awareness of a high probability is based on what you know about your business and your customers. That's where you get to shape the narrative and you get to draw those lines and then defend them. But if you don't proactively take steps to implement, Brent, what you and I have referred to as the high probability protocol, that's really a add-on to an existing export controls compliance program, someone else is going to be calling those shots for you and you're not going to like the lines that they're drawing.
That's the salt in the stew. That high probability protocol is just going to cut through everything. That's where the real risk lies. That's where the measures taken to protect the company and its officers and directors and its legal and compliance personnel, that's where it's going to lie. That's where the rubber meets the road. This is a good segue just to propose 50% rule that we saw in the Dow Jones Risk Journal article from earlier today.
Brent, there's a lot of focus on this rule as suddenly creating a burden that didn't previously exist. I keep being a little curious about that, to be honest, and I don't want to say that that's wrong. I don't want to diminish the burden of having to investigate every affiliate that might be 50% owned or more of a listed entity. It's going to be a field day for the due diligence companies, right? To me, though, I think that's something that has already been knowable. And so I'm wondering, is this really a new burden on people anyway? You could see the government, maybe unfairly, maybe retroactively with the benefit of hindsight where something really bad happens, saying, well, even when an entity isn't on the entity list, if its parent entity is on the list, are you able to show us the due diligence that you did before determining that there was not a high probability of diversion to the listed entity? Because as the entity list exists today, it sits there along with and alongside the inchoate provisions of the EAR under Part 764.2. Conspiracy, aiding and abetting, causing, material misrepresentation, acting with knowledge of a violation. You could very easily see that if you're shipping an item to a 50% owned subsidiary of an entity on the entity list, that the government might ask you, how do you really think that that item is not going to the parent? I know that there's a lot of reference to the OFAC 50% rule as a model for this, and that it works there, it should work here. To me, there's a slightly different purpose behind export controls than the purpose behind economic sanctions. OFAC states over and over and over again that the purpose of a designation, of designating someone as a sanctioned person, as a specially designated national or SDN, is to change that person's behavior. Whether it's a corporate entity, whether it's a natural person, they are doing something we don't like. We want that person's behavior to change. And if because of the sanctions, they have to sell some shares in something, sell some companies, or life just is a little more difficult for them, that's the purpose of those sanctions, try to encourage them to change their own behavior. It's a focus on them. When you're talking about export controls, fundamentally, we don't want dangerous items to go to bad actors who will do bad things with them. It's maybe a bit unfair, but just throw it out there for discussion. Do we really think smugglers care about corporate forms? Do we think they care about corporate structures or shareholdings? Do we think that smugglers only are controlled through shareholding structures? There's lots of governments and political parties in the world that don't need to own shares in a company to direct that company's activities.
Like the Chinese Communist Party in the PRC.
If we're really worried about an item going to a parent entity because the government has concluded that there's a national security risk, do we really think there's less of a risk if it goes to a subsidiary? Do we really care what the ownership percentage is? Do we think there's less of a risk if it goes to a 20% subsidiary in Malaysia as opposed to a 51% subsidiary on mainland China? What if we see that that 20% owned subsidiary used to be a 50% owned subsidiary, and then right around when public debate in the United States started to heat up around this potential change to the rule, that shareholding was changed, or let's just say that entity was created within the last 3 or 4 months to borrow, not this is a legal standard, but to borrow from Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler's great segment on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. Really? Do we really think that that's what's happening here? As trite as that might be, that's essentially at some level what the high probability standard boils down to. It allows a regulator with the benefit of hindsight to look at you and say, did you really think that wasn't happening? Is it a scientific standard? Absolutely not. Is it unfairly viewed with 2020 hindsight? Always. It always comes up when something bad has happened and the government is asking you, why did this happen? Did you really think it wouldn't happen? Even today, the government could take the position that we hope you're doing due diligence, risk-based due diligence, but due diligence on affiliates and subsidiaries of any entity on the entity list before you send something to them that you could not send to the parent entity or whatever the listed entity is. Why do you really think it's not going to be diverted to that entity? Yes, if you adopt a 50% rule, it makes that decision for you and says for these entities, it's not even a choice. You're going to have to do it. But that doesn't exclude the need to think about risk-based due diligence for entities that are 49% owned or 20% owned, or maybe not even owned at all, but just rumored to be affiliated, or maybe they happen to show up at the same meeting with party officials in Beijing.
You made a lot of good points there, Mike. What I would say, and I think the government's going to come down on this position as well, is that this proposed rule really adds no more compliance burden than what already exists under the law. It's important to recognize that facts and circumstances are important. This goes back to that original Fresh Looks article that kicked off our Fresh Looks series, When Loopholes Create Liability Pitfalls, a Fresh Look at Export Controls, where we outlined the scenario where, let's say you've got a customer goes on an entity list, and then you ship to a subsidiary. That's just not a free pass. You're going to have to demonstrate that you've applied that high probability standard in identifying and mitigating those red flags. Otherwise, that's not going to look good if the enforcement officials come knocking on the door. We saw this same fact pattern in that recent case that came out at the end of July. The discussion that's going on in terms of why has this rule been delayed since May, what's going on, is really missing the mark. And then at the end of the day, the government is looking at solutions to close real or perceived loopholes in export controls. And they're thinking long and hard about it before they lay down a rule and you just have something reactive out there, which then doesn't solve the ultimate issue, which then ends up being an even bigger mess because everybody gets riled over it. And then it ends up the boom comes back and just hitting everybody in the head again.
What's the real issue that should drive corporate behavior in this? It's not that now you're going to have to look at a bunch more subsidiaries and affiliates. The risk to you is if you sell to something that's not 50% owned, you're not getting a free pass. There is nothing that's been reported about this, and nothing that you or I expect from any conversations we've had with anybody, that in adopting this 50% rule, there's going to be this corollary, go ahead and ship it if you got it, for someone who's 49.9% owned. All these other provisions still apply. The end use and end user provisions still apply. The Incoit provisions still apply. General Prohibition 10 still applies. You may get lulled into a false sense of security. Great, it's 49%, we're good. But again, holistic and dynamic risk, those are the key things we keep coming back to, Brent, over and over and over again. Why? Because that's your real bet the company enforcement risk. It's what idea was too good to be true that you jumped on, and the government's going to look at you like you're a crazy person 3 years later, 5 years later, when massive smuggling happened, just because you weren't looking at quite the right trends and you weren't looking at the right changes to your trade flows, that like 100,000% increase in sales of Kazakhstan just aren't going to be fun to have to explain later. Well, Brent, that brings us to managing up for this episode. What is your managing up advice for today?
If you want to take advantage of the carrots, you're going to also have to protect yourself against the sticks. In the world where we operate today, more transparency and export controls from soup to nuts is coming and will increase over time. These are driven by larger trends in play. If you want to take advantage of those carrots as part of the United States' export policy, you're going to have to protect yourself against the sticks of export enforcement, because they're going to come hand in hand. So don't get lost in the weeds focused on processes or adding new processes that don't add value or may even expose your company to more risk. Cut right through it. In this world, substance over form matters. So make sure that you're focused on the substance, and that substance revolves around the full definition of knowledge in the EAR.
Well said, Brent. Coming back to the revenue sharing arrangement, there's been some criticism in the media of this being essentially state capitalism, not unlike that in China right now. But it would be a mistake to think that comes with some sort of protection. If anything, it comes with greater exposure and risks for all the reasons we talked about today. The only way to protect yourself is on the front end by doing risk-based due diligence with an eye towards the high probability standard, so that when you're asked, why did you make the decisions you made, you can defend those. Well, Brent, that concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well. And to everyone else out there, be well.